to open a public hearing on House Bill 2446. Teresa, you want to?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. House Bill 2446 is brought to you by Resident Cameron at the request of Steve Moore. It authorizes the placement of video lottery game terminals in establishments holding a brewery public house license issued by the Liquor Control Commission. And in front of you, committee members, there's a sheet like this. It's a synopsis of the different types of OLCC licenses we'll be dealing with today. It just has a brief synopsis of the privileges under each license.
Okay. All righty then. I'm going to call Representative Cameron and Mr. Moore up here, please. Right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Kevin Cameron, House District 19. It's great to be here and introduce to you House Bill 2446. Basically, it comes at the request, and I'll let Steve talk about some of the details, comes at the request of Steve Moore, who is one of two people that I have found in the state of Oregon that this bill may have a impact on directly. There could be others out there that we haven't found out yet. But basically, what this House bill does is allow an individual with a brew pub license to apply for video lottery. Currently, when you look at the statute, brew pub is not in there. So you have to, if you have a brew pub license, which under a brew pub license allows you to serve respectively Chair Schaffler, some good beer that's made in the brew pub as well as other beers.
That's important.
Under that one license. But in order to have video poker or video lottery, you have to also apply for a another OLCC license based on the statute. So what this is requesting, for example, in Mr. Moore's case, he has to actually apply for two licenses just to have video lottery, even though all he serves is beer and wine in this. Well, you don't even serve beer or wine in your restaurants.
No wine.
So that's it in a nutshell.
All righty then. Mr. Moore?
I've tried to find out what the genesis of this is, and it's been a little hazy, but essentially I think the lottery precedes the brew pub. Stephen Moore, Philadelphia Steaks and Hoagies, and I live in Westland, Oregon. The lottery precedes the brew pub bills, and so when they originally opened it up, it was the real focus was so that liquor licenses would have a controlled area to control people of 21 years of age and older. And that's really where it came from. And then when brew pubs came along, there wasn't much demand, and so it never happened. I served on Senate Task Force, I believe it was 300, about 8 years ago, where they consolidated the licenses. There was no real discussion about it at that time. I thought it was going to be included when they redid the licenses, but it was not included. So what it really boils down to today is I buy my brew pub license for $250. I pay the city of Portland $35 to prove it. And then I have to purchase a second license from the OLCC, a restaurant license that the only additional privilege I get is that it's I'm allowed to do the lottery games, the video poker games. I'm a small poker retailer. I only have three machines. It's a very small part of my business, but it is part of my business. So for the last 12 or 14 years, I've been spending an extra $300 a year just for another license, and as best I can find, it's just a matter of housekeeping. There's no real reason why I should have to do that. There are 60, I checked with the lottery, there are 60-some licenses that have both brew pub and restaurant licenses in the state. One reason to do that is the brew pub is not allowed to serve hard alcohol, but you can piggyback the licenses, and so when you buy the restaurant license, then you're allowed to serve hard alcohol. Out of those 60, 22 of those have actually 22 of the brew pub restaurant licensees have video poker. So the most people it could affect in the state are 22. Some of those 22, they have purchased that second license for the privilege of selling hard alcohol and may not have video poker. I talked to the lottery a couple times, Marcia Hutchinson a few times, and I've been unable to figure out exactly who the list of those 22 are. There is one other in the state that I'm aware of, Rod Kassir from Mia Pia's Pizza Place in Klamath Falls. So as far as I know, there's two, but there's probably more than that, but the absolute most could be 22. So that was the purpose of it, and I'd like your consideration to, probably keep my kids in sneakers for a year, the three of them. So it may not be a lot of money, but it's just another fee that doesn't seem any reason for. The fiscal impact could cost the state between $500 and maybe $6,000 if all 22 stop buying the second license, and I don't really feel that's a good reason to for the second license.
Great. Any questions? Pretty straightforward, I think. Oh, for me, any questions for this nice panel? All righty then. Thanks, guys. This is the public hearing today.
Thank you very much.
Okay, is there anyone else that wants to testify on House Bill 2446 today? All right, then. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2446 and open the public hearing on 2486. And I have Jess Lyon. Hope I said that right. If you didn't, correct me, please, when you identify yourself for the record.
Chairman Choppler, members of the committee. My name is Jesse Lyon. I'm a partner at the Davis Wright Germain Law Firm in Portland. We represent a number of individual Oregon vineyards and wineries and also serve as general counsel to the Oregon Wine Growers Association, and I'm here today on the Oregon Wine Growers Association's behalf. Under current law, all Oregon wineries are required to give a surety bond to the OLCC to cover unpaid wine taxes. For most wineries, this means paying a third-party surety company a few $100s for a bond that ends up being about $1,000 a year of coverage. Our bill would do two things. First, it creates a discretionary exception to the surety bond requirement for those small wineries which are already eligible to for small production exceptions for wine privilege taxes. What this means is that small wineries could be able to avoid the expense of paying a third-party surety for bonds where there is, in fact, no likely wine tax obligation, and that tax payment wouldn't exist. This also would help the Oregon Liquor Control Commission avoid the unnecessary burden of tracking bonds, again, where there's no wine tax that is expected to be required. And again, that's a discretionary exception. The second thing that the bill does, it fills an unforeseen gap also in current law by permitting the surety bonds that are in place to cover grape tonnage taxes. Oregon wineries pay tax in two forms. One, privilege tax against the wine that they release from bond here in Oregon, from their bonded premises here in Oregon. And secondly, a payment that is actually essentially an assessment against the grape that they use and process into wine. So our bill would not only create discretionary exemptions from the bond requirement, but also make sure that those bonds that are in place can apply to grape tonnage taxes as well. And I'm just appreciate your consideration of the bill and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Lyon today? And Representative Berger, please.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the grape tonnage tax.
Mm-hmm.
Would you explain it a little further?
Sure. For grapes that are processed into wine here in Oregon, the receiving winery pays $25 a ton on those taxes, and those taxes are directed to be applied towards primarily research activities conducted through OSU and other institutions to further our viticulture industry.
Okay. That helps me. And Mr. Chair, if I can pursue,
please.
And this bill changes that how? It requires that they have a bond on this tax?
Right.
The growers or the receivers?
The bond is actually on the wineries. And that's because it's the wineries, that's correct, the receivers, because they are the ones who report and pay the grape tonnage tax. And they, so this bill would allow the bonds that are already in place very clearly to apply not only to wine taxes, but also to those grape tonnage taxes. Both of them are collected by the commission currently.
Thank you.
And then there's great broad industry support for this, right?
That's right.
Good. Any other questions? All right, then. Thanks a lot, Mr.
Thank
Lyon.
You.
Does anyone else want to testify on House Bill 2486 today? All right, then. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2486 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2487. Teresa.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2487 allows wine or cider from a licensed warehouse to be shipped to a retail licensee if the shipment is made pursuant to a sale by a holder of a grower sales privilege license or a wholesale malt beverage and wine license.
All right. Well, Mr. Lyon, you should have just stayed up here. Mm-hmm. Sorry I didn't catch you first. Which one does this go with?
Chairman Schaffler, Jesse Lyon again, on behalf of the Oregon Wine Growers Association, in support of House Bill 2487. This bill we view as a technical correction to Oregon law governing wine warehouses. Under current Oregon law, Oregon wine warehouses, some of you may know, like the Abbey Wine Warehouse, which is fairly well regarded up in Oregon wine country. Oregon wine warehouses may remove their wine from their licensed warehouse on behalf of their winery customers that store wine there, in conjunction with that winery's sale to licensed retailers, such as a wine shop or a restaurant. However, again, I think due to an oversight, warehouses currently can't provide that same services for similarly situated businesses in our industry. Namely, that's two kinds of industry members. One would be vineyard operators who get what's called a grower sales privilege license. Those are folks who purchase and resell what is essentially private label wine made for them by other wineries. And also there are wholesale malt beverage and wine licensees who may not be vineyard producers themselves, but again, have a private label wine made for them so they can start developing their wine brand perhaps before they have their own winery. These two groups of businesses aren't able to take advantage of the licensed warehouse's full services. So House Bill 2487 would revise current law by making this technical correction, enabling both grower sales privilege licensees and these wholesale licensees to include them in the group of licensees who can have wine removed from the warehouse in connection with the licensee sale to a wine shop, restaurant, or other retailer, essentially providing an equitable playing field for all suppliers of Oregon wine. Without this, we end up with a kind of unusual set of circumstances, which mean if a winery has its wine stored at the warehouse and wishes to make a sale, for example, to a retailer, the warehouse has to release the wine first for shipment all the way back to the winery, which may be in a distant part of the state, and then the winery would have to redeliver it back to the retailer. So this kind of shortcuts some additional travel for that product that ultimately is headed for the same destination. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Any questions of Mr. Lyon today on this bill? Representative Foley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just noticed the continuing reference to cider in here, and which does not include malt beverages. Is that correct?
That's right.
They're separate items that...
Yes, Representative Foley, wine and cider are generally treated from a regulatory perspective under our current law as the same product. Hard cider manufacturers obtain a winery license because they're fermenting a fruit product in order to produce alcohol.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thanks, Mr. Lyon. Does anyone else today want to testify on House Bill 2487? All right, well, if not, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2487 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2488.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2488 requires that a person who possesses a valid wine direct shipper permit to sell and ship wine or cider directly to an individual. It provides that the person receiving wine must be at least 21 years of age and is receiving wine for personal use and not for resale. The measure specifies persons who may apply for a wine shipper permit and also establishes labeling requirements for wine or cider that is direct shipped directly to an individual. The measure also provides that a person holding the permit is responsible for paying all privilege checks on wine or cider that are shipped under the permit and also establishes a fee and bond require amounts for the permit. The measure finally allows certain nonprofit trade associations whose members holding wholesale licenses to also hold retail licenses, as long as the sales under this retail license are primarily for the purpose of promoting the sale of wines produced by association members or containing grapes or fruit produced by association members.
All right. Let's call Gary Conklin and Tom Wark and Katie Jacore, please. Gary, if you want to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Conkling. Jess Lyon will give you the principal testimony on behalf of the OWA, but I wanted to make just a prefatory comment about this bill and a bill that you will hear later, House Bill 2677. They deal with two privileges, direct shipment of wine to customers and the ability of a winery to distribute its products directly to a retailer or another licensee in the state. These two privileges for Oregon wineries are two of the most important privileges that we have, given that we have very small, medium-sized wineries that don't often have other distribution channels. It's hard for them to get on grocery shelves. Sometimes it's hard to get placement in restaurants. So my point in this prefatory comment, Mr. Chair, is to note that direct shipment is very, very important. It's probably the highest priority for our industry, followed very closely by our ability to self-distribute. And with that, if I may, Mr. Lyon can, as the person on behalf of OWA, to walk through 2488.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Come on up, Mr. Lyon. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Jesse Lyon, again, for OWA. A few things in support of House Bill 2488. First, I think we're here with the understanding that Oregon's current direct shipping statutes, which historically have served us very well under what is known as the reciprocal privileges, that is, Oregon can ship to and Oregon residents can receive wine from states that have allowed this free trade in wine directly to consumers. Although while those laws may have served us well, under recent rulings by the United States Supreme Court, those laws, in fact, themselves may be unconstitutional. So Oregon's law presently allows wineries, grower sales privilege licensees, and retailers from Oregon and from reciprocal states to ship limited amounts of wine directly to Oregon and out-of-state consumers where permissible, as long as those consumers are over the age of 21. In order to deal with the Supreme Court's decision, instead of relying on reciprocal law language, we instead create an Oregon direct shipper permit for qualified businesses that wish to ship wine directly to Oregon consumers. Our bill would automatically grant this direct shipper permit to Oregon wineries, grower sales privilege licensees, and retailers at no additional license fee or cost. That is, it'd be built into their existing Oregon license fees and privileges. And that way, all of these Oregon businesses could retain existing rights that they currently have. As to out-of-state licensees, again, House Bill 2488 effectively retains the status quo by enabling out-of-state wineries, growers, and retailers to also obtain wine direct shipment permits to reach our consumers here if they go through a reasonable permit process, pay an annual fee, pay all applicable taxes, make annual reports, and are subject to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's jurisdiction as they are today. All other requirements of the Oregon direct shipping law would be applied equally both to our in-state businesses and out-of-state businesses. Again, because Oregon currently allows direct shipments from retailers and wineries in other reciprocal states, which, by the way, have included historically all of the largest wine-producing states that we compete with, namely in California, Washington, and also most recently New York, each of those businesses under current law has been registering as an out-of-state wine shipper. So we think that our bill, by moving to a more formal permit process, should have actually a fairly modest marginal impact on the OLCC's regulatory caseload, and certainly in no way would 2488 take away the OLCC's existing power to regulate direct shipments in Oregon or interfere with the agency's authority to collect wine taxes. In terms of the impact on the wine industry, Gary spoke to it a bit, but the ability to sell and ship wine directly to consumers is hugely important for Oregon in particular, where even our largest wineries are actually small wineries in the global wine market. These small wineries depend upon the ability to ship directly as a means to market access because, particularly in a world of consolidating to distribution groups and large retailers, it's very difficult to find your wine on a store shelf when you're dealing in small volume brands. So in order to reach out to customers who may have visited the tasting room or received recommendations from friends or read about a fine small volume wine in the New York Times, we would hope that our consumers, our wineries, would be able to reach those consumers by direct shipment sales. And it's also important to know that those direct-to-consumer sales channels, such as tasting room activity and direct shipments, although not necessarily always the largest value of, largest component of a winery's revenue, is almost always among the highest centers for net profits to the winery's bottom lines. We've also, you may hear from time to time some groups wondering out loud whether wine direct shipment programs increase minor access to alcohol, but in fact the facts do not bear this out. The Federal Trade Commission and the United States Supreme Court both looked closely at this issue and found that there have been few or no occurrences of minors purchasing wine through direct shipment sales. And here in Oregon, the OWA and our wine industry takes very seriously its responsibility to avoid sales to minors. We provide ongoing counsel and awareness about the importance with complying with all of these direct shipment rules that are presented here and in other destination states. And just by point of information, both under existing law and our bill, shipping cartons have to be conspicuously marked. Adult signatures required to receive wine shipments. Finally, an additional effect of our bill would be to allow nonprofit trade associations, whose individual members are primarily licensed wineries or vineyard operators, the ability to sell and ship wine directly to Oregon consumers. We didn't make that an exclusive term because many winery associations have non-winery members, such as vineyard operators, who may not require an OLCC license, but nonetheless their interests are represented by the association. So an example of this kind of trade association would be the Columbia Gorge Wine Growers Association or the Yamhill County Wineries Association. Unfortunately, under current Oregon tied house laws, those have been interpreted to prevent winery trade associations from obtaining even temporary sales licenses because they're deemed a retail license, and because these associations are controlled by manufacturers, generally manufacturers may not also own or control retail licenses. In this case, we don't think that makes good common sense because all of the members of this association have retail privileges themselves under their winery license. So in order to make some common sense out of this, we have drafted our language to make it clear that in order to qualify for a direct shipper permit under 2048 or make other retail sales, the associations have to be made up of entities that already qualify for these privileges standing alone. So allowing this group to sell collectively through their association would do two things. It would solidify their role in Oregon's unique viticultural regions and allow collective sales efforts to promote and attract tourism and consumer interest in each of the region's wine products. So House Bill 2488 would rectify this little problem by allowing wine trade associations this limited exception that their winery members already enjoy. So, in summary, House Bill 2488 effectively would put Oregon in compliance with recent Supreme Court shipment cases and also create a workable wine direct shipment permit system that benefits both Oregon wineries and Oregon consumers. I'm happy to answer any other questions, right, or I can wait for those questions.
Yeah, Mr. Work, why don't you just go ahead?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thanks for letting us testify on 2488 and to talk about direct shipping. My name is Tom Work, and I represent the Specialty Wine Retailers Association. SWRA is a collection of retailers across the country, large and small. They include brick-and-mortar retailers. They include auction houses. They include catalog wine merchants, and they include Internet wine merchants. Our mission is to advocate on behalf of our members for open markets and for wine direct shipping laws that are fairly applied. With that, what I'd like to do is just offer a little bit of background and reiterate a few things. For nearly 20 years, consumers in Oregon have had the right to purchase and have shipped to them wines from retailers both in the state and outside of the state. In fact, by passing the reciprocity agreements, the state of Oregon has encouraged this form of commerce and this form of connection between the retailer and the consumer. However, in 2005, the Supreme Court issued its Granholm v. Heald Supreme Court decision. That decision dealt with the Commerce Clause as it relates to direct shipment of wine. And basically what they said was, indeed, a state has the right to regulate how wine is distributed within its borders. But with regard to shippers of wine, it has to treat in-state shippers and out-of-state shippers fairly on an even playing field. In addition to that, it also noted that reciprocity agreements, like the one under which Oregon currently works, is unconstitutional and needs to be reworked. That's exactly what 2488 does. So with that, let me mention the reasons why SWRA supports 2488. In the first case, and this is important, it was written after discussions with all the stakeholders, retailers, wineries, wholesalers, the OLCC, and consumers. This is important because in a lot of states where direct shipping legislation gets introduced, oftentimes all the stakeholders are included in the initial discussions. The result of that is usually unfair or discriminatory laws. HB 2488 is decidedly not discriminatory in any way, and that's one of the reasons we support it. Also, 2488 keeps in place a channel of commerce that Oregonians have come to rely on for almost two decades now. Along those same lines, it keeps in place a channel of commerce upon which retailers have come to rely and, in some cases, have built their businesses. And with regard to wineries, it keeps in place a channel of commerce that's been critical to their amazing success and to their quality orientation. Finally, we support 2488 because it finally gives Oregon a way by which to collect taxes on those wines that are shipped into the state from retailers and wineries from outside. Now, had there been a lot of problems associated with direct shipment over the last 20 years, we would understand why this committee and why the state of Oregon might want to retreat on its support of direct shipping. But the fact is there have not been problems of any magnitude with regard to direct shipping to consumers. So, with that, what I'd like to do now is, if I could, address a couple concerns that have been brought up with regard to the direct shipment of wine and retailers. The first is the idea that the OLCC is going to be inundated with thousands of requests for direct shipping permits from retailers. Our experience suggests that's not the case, and I'd like to use New Hampshire as an example. New Hampshire has had a direct shipping process in place now for since 1998, very similar to the one you're considering here. Since 1998, they've issued a total of roughly 700 permits to wineries and retailers from out of state. According to Jim Barbuti, who administers that program, no more than 10% of those are issued to retailers. And that's a good reason for that. For the most part, retailers are still selling wine inside the brick-and-mortar process. The amount of direct shipping by retailers has increased substantially over the past 10 years, but it's really wineries who have taken advantage of the system. And the reason is most wineries don't have tasting rooms. So if they want to reach out to consumers, they have to use the direct shipping process. So it makes sense that of the 700 permits that have been issued in New Hampshire, only 10% would have come from retailers or gone to retailers. Oregon also has a permit process in place. And since about 1990, they've issued roughly 665 permits to out-of-state shippers. I don't know what the percentage is, how much has gone to retailers or to wineries. I suspect it's the same, however. So the idea that Oregon is going to be overwhelmed with thousands of out-of-state retailers wanting to ship here is unlikely. I'd also note that with regard to enforcement mechanisms, there's been some concern that the OLCC may not have the mechanisms in place to enforce a new direct shipment legislation. The way 2488 is written now, out-of-state retailers and wineries would submit themselves to Oregon jurisdiction. That's one mechanism they have. There's also the 21st Amendment Act, which was passed by Congress in 2000. This act allows states' attorneys general to take out-of-state shippers into federal court if they violate state laws. So you really have two good forms of two good mechanisms by which to enforce the regulations in 2488. And so with that, I'd just like to conclude by saying that for nearly 20 years, direct shipping has been a successful nod to free trade here in Oregon. And it's been considered a safe, effective, and an efficient way for wineries, retailers, and Oregonians to obtain the wines that they want and sell the wines that they make or retail. We believe 2488 warrants your support because it preserves those rights that have been in place now for retailers, consumers, and wineries for up to two decades. So, do you have any questions?
Ms. Chikoy, I hope I'm saying your name right.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Katie Chikoy, and I'm Western Counsel for the California Wine Institute. I appreciate the opportunity of being here today and providing some testimony on House Bill 2844, which the California Wine Institute supports. I'm going to do my best not to repeat my colleagues' comments, and I agree wholeheartedly with both of them. And this bill is important to us because it replaces Oregon's reciprocity law with a more regulated permit system, which will allow your Oregon consumers to obtain wine from those wineries and retailers who choose to get a permit in Oregon in any of the 50 states. It provides a good regulated process, the wine that will be tax paid. There's restrictions as to the labels that need to go in the boxes to help protect the public. And we think it's a good process that you should support. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
All right. Any questions for this panel today? Representative Holby, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure this is probably a pretty easy question for you, but I just wanted to double check, I guess, why is the fee and bond waived for the winery licensee under 471.223 and also for the grower sales privilege license? I suppose they're already paying a license already, and can you just explain why they're being exempted from the bond and the annual fee?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, you are correct. Oregon wineries are already paying a $250 a year fee for their winery license, similarly same for grower sales privilege licensees, so those fees are already being paid as a part of their package of Oregon privileges. Out-of-state shippers, in order to obtain the privileges, would pay that additional license fee.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thanks a lot. That was everybody that signed up for four. I'm going to call Paul Romain, who signed up as neutral. And then we'll come to the people that are signed up as against, if anyone wants to know what order I'm going in. Mr. Romain, how are you?
Oh, hunky dory.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to comment on Mr. Romain's tie, if I could.
All right.
Superb tie.
Thank you. I hope you agree that the testimony also will be superb, but I'll get into that in a second here.
All right.
I figured it was appropriate today. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association, and we're schizophrenic, neutral, whatever, about this particular bill. But I also want to take the opportunity to comment a little bit on another bill that's before you, which is 2171, which was written by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. It covers basically the same topic, and I'm going to give you a little bit of a history. I just want to point out, I find it very interesting that you're told that 10% of the permits, remember the language, 10% of the permits to ship into New Hampshire are issued to retailers. What they didn't say was at least a couple of years ago, according to the California Wine Institute, about 80 to 85% of the volume of shipping is done by retailers, not by wineries. Let's go back to how this began. What happened was when the Oregon...
Mr. Romain, you all shut off your electrical devices, your phones, your pages, your Blackberries, any other machine you have, because that noise you just heard is somebody's phone or something going off. I'm going to check mine right now, too. Well, forgive me. Carry on.
I don't think mine went off, but it was on. But sorry if it did. It's off. Mine's off. I'm clean.
All right. Thank you.
I'm clean. Where was I? When this began, it was a great effort, a brilliant effort, actually, by the Oregon wine growers. They came up with the idea of reciprocity. What we had at that time was a fairly vigorous, you couldn't ship out of the state into another state. You couldn't ship wine back over here. The Oregon wine industry wanted to grow. They came up with an ingenious way of, look, we can't get wholesalers to really take our product in a lot of these states. So we have to figure out a way to get our product out to those states to consumers because it's a great product. They produce some great stuff. And to do that, what we're going to have to do is grant to that state that allows us in the reciprocal privilege of shipping into us. So let's create a law that basically says, if you show me yours, I'll show you mine, that kind of law. In other words, you do it, we'll do it. And it worked well, except that we have a little thing called the Commerce Clause in the U.S. Constitution that says you really can't set up trade barriers like that. Along comes the Granholm case a few years ago at the U.S. Supreme Court. I actually had the privilege of participating as amicus, writing an amicus brief in that case. Unfortunately, on the side that got 4 votes, not the side that got 5 votes. So position wasn't accepted. But what that case said was that you cannot, at the producer level, discriminate in-state versus out-of-state. It didn't go any further than that with wine. It basically said that if you allow your winery in-state to ship directly to a consumer in-state, you have to allow the winery out-of-state to ship directly to a consumer in your state. Now, you can level up or level down. It's up to you. But in Oregon, there's no way we're leveling down. We're not going to take away the privilege of the Oregon wine grower. They need that. It's an essential part of their business. So we're basically crafting now, with 2488 and 2171, you're crafting the way to allow the winery to get to market. Remember, that was the original intent. The enforcement mechanism against a winery is very interesting. It's pretty easy. Wineries have to get a federal permit. And if they violate the laws of any state, they can lose that federal permit. So it's irrelevant if the winery's in Kansas or Oklahoma or California or any place else. They have a real hammer over their head because if they violate the laws of Oregon, they could lose their federal permit. Retailers don't have that. Retailers are kind of out there. And there really isn't an effective hammer to get at a retailer, even if they consent to jurisdiction here, even if they, we have the basically useless 21st Amendment Enforcement Act, there is really no way to enforce the laws against a retailer. And remember that about 80% of the shipping comes from the retail community. Now, currently, under current law, the Oregon retailer can ship out of state. They can ship out of state no matter what you do with this. Basically, it's the receiving state that has to say it's okay to bring it in, not the state that it's being sent from. So the Oregon retailer really is not going to be affected by this bill. How many other states have allowed, in effect, the Oregon retailer, if you would, to ship directly in? Very few. There are some reciprocity statutes that are still out there. They're probably unconstitutional, as Jesse said earlier. But basically what you're saying here is that we are going to give all these retailers in other states the ability to ship in where our retailers may not have the ability to ship into their states. Who are these retailers? Retailers are basically places like Sam's in Chicago, Zaki's in New York, K&L in California. They're very large. They buy in volume. They can get product probably cheaper than my wholesalers can get half the time. And they can ship it in. Do they have a big incentive to follow the law? Not really. Some of them do, and they're very good about it, but probably in sting operations, if you look around the country when attorneys general do sting operations in this area, that's probably the biggest area that's violated. It's not the winery that violates it. Wineries are pretty clear about they don't want to lose their privilege. It's the retail end that you'll find the most problem with. We support this bill in as much as it gives and retains the ability of the Oregon winery to ship and all wineries to basically ship directly to consumers. That's what you should do from a business standpoint. It makes sense from the state standpoint, and you can enforce it. We just have some problems and think it needs a little work on the retail end of the shipping. and I think the Liquor Control Commission will also have some problems in that area also. But it's, again, we are in 100% support of the winery's privilege to do this. We think that's, you know, given the new ground rules that are out there, given the Granholm case, you need to support the wineries on this one. But do you need to go as far as granting it to the retail trade out there? Now, this is where I get schizophrenic about it. In reality, you're really talking about a little bit of high-end wine coming into the state. Basically, anybody who knows wine is going to be probably ordering it, real high-end wine, probably through the mail. Or it's not really through the mail. It's through a delivery service. You're going to be shopping the Internet for the best price. You're going to be sending it in. Now, I realize that there has not been anybody basically hurt yet by any of that. But just remember, when something comes into the state in a package, first of all, is it marked properly? I have one particular incident in the family. We set it up, but my daughter actually, under my instructions, called a wine shop in San Francisco and had wine sent directly to her, and all they wanted was her credit card and her address. That was it. So there is a problem there. My suggestion is that you have the wineries work with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and see if something can be worked out so that the winery privilege of in effect, self-distribution and sales to retailers or to consumers all around the country is preserved. The Oregon wine growers need that. We don't think you need to go as far as the retail shipment to allow other retailers from outside the state to ship in. Thank you.
Any questions? I have one question, Mr. Romain. The other retailers, if they shipped some, if some miner got some wine from them, they'd be held as accountable with this or without this under the federal laws, right? Isn't that correct? I mean, they would lose their ability to sell wine, wouldn't they?
Mr. Chair, no.
So they could just sell the miners?
Well, no. You couldn't enforce it against them. It's very, very difficult. What you should do is get the Attorney General's office in here to ask them whether or not they basically could enforce against an out-of-state retailer or just how much trouble it would be to enforce against an out-of-state retailer. The mechanisms, in theory, it's all there. In reality, it's not. Whereas a winery has a lot to lose. If they lose something, if they're convicted of violating something in this state, they can lose their federal permit. A retailer doesn't have that. A retailer can basically just say, all right, I won't ship into Oregon anymore.
All righty then. Any more questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Judith Berkanovich, I hope I'm saying that right, and Donna Randell, please, come on up. And just so everybody knows, this is the first public hearing. Hope you're all taking notes. Come back and respond to anything that's said on when and if we have a second public hearing for any of these bills today. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'm Judith Bersanovich. I'm the director of the Administrative Policy and Process Division at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The OLCC has several concerns regarding this bill, and the commission has taken a position in opposition to it in its current form. You've heard about the Granholm decision, and that was in 2005. The U.S. Supreme Court required that states equalize the privilege between in-state and out-of-state manufacturers of wine, producers, and that was the only level, the only tier that was impacted when it concerns direct shipment of wine to consumers. This bill would do that much, but it goes much further than that. It contains provisions that exceed the Granholm requirements. It contains provisions that relate to subjects other than, or at least a subject other than, direct shipment. And in at least one instance would create an additional Granholm problem. Furthermore, it doesn't provide for penalties. It doesn't provide for denial criteria or cancellation or suspension criteria. The first subject with me, I'm sorry, I apologize, is Donna Vandal, the Technical Services Coordinator, and we'll be addressing different portions of the bill. The first section I want to address is the eligibility for the permit. This bill would add those who hold grower sales privileges to the list that could direct ship. I don't think there's any particular problem with that. I want to speak mostly about retailers. You've heard the explanation of the current Oregon reciprocal statute, but what you haven't heard is that it only allows the shipment of up to 2 cases per month. It's a very limited quantity. And retailers, and it does, the reciprocal statute currently does include wineries and retailers, and it's a very small quantity, 2 cases per month. The current bills before you both have unlimited quantities. There are a lot of reasons for that. But it does change the landscape. We're talking small quantity and unlimited quantity. OLCC's bill, unlike 2048, would not extend it to retailers, this privilege. It would certainly to wineries and equalize that. Several reasons. The inclusion of retail off-premise sales licensees exceeds the Grand Home holding. There was no requirement in Grand Home other than the manufacturer tier, in-state, out-of-state, be treated the same. There's no requirement manufacturers and retailers be treated the same or that retailers and retailers be treated the same. The OLCC's particular regulatory concern is with out-of-state retailers. You've heard some of the reasons. Mr. Romain just testified. The state of Oregon has no ultimate regulatory hook on out-of-state retailers, and now we're talking unlimited quantities that will be directly shipped to consumers. Unlike in-state retailers and in-state wineries, there's a license, an underlying license, if the entity is being non-compliant. Wineries have a federal license. There's no such equivalent for retailers. Including retailers would go beyond what most states have done with respect to this issue, including our nearest neighbors, California and Washington. Their statutes, as are most, limited to wine producers, because that's the Grand Home decision, and do not include retailers. And if our neighbors don't allow Oregon wineries or Oregon retailers to ship in, but they can ship into Oregon, it's hard to see how that benefits Oregon businesses. Including retailers among those eligible for a direct shipping permit could also exponentially increase the number of permits. We don't have all states have retailers, not all states have wine industries. And there are 50 states. So I heard the example about New Hampshire, but I don't know the proportions in terms of number of permits, but we're talking 50 states here. We're not talking reciprocal states. In terms of impact on existing privileges, declining to add retailers to those eligible to receive a direct shipper permit under this bill, or under either bill, does not take away the existing privilege of in-state licensees with retail privileges to deliver wine to consumers under ORS 471305. That still exists. Whether in-state retailers can ship out-of-state doesn't depend on our law. It depends on the receiving state's law. So that isn't impacted. In other words, whether another state such as Washington or California would permit Oregon retailers to ship in. Declining to add retailers would take away an existing limited privilege for out-of-state retailers from certain states, those considered reciprocal with Oregon, and those are approximately 13, to ship 2 cases of wine per month to Oregon residents. There's no requirement under Grand Home that retailers be included. There is a risk that not including out-of-state retailers could generate a lawsuit. It has, this has occurred in at least two other states, one of them being our neighbor, California. Ms. Vandal would like to address another of the eligibility issues that related to trade association issues.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Donna Vandal. I'm the Technical Services Coordinator with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. In addition to the issues previously mentioned, this bill would allow a trade association of wineries and other entities to obtain a wine shipper permit, with the requirement that the trade association must hold another license, either an off-premises sales license or a temporary sales license issued either by Oregon or another state. Now, our concerns with including trade associations in the bill are several. First of all, we believe it's not necessary to include winery trade associations to allow them to ship to consumers because the member wineries would already be authorized to ship their products directly. In addition, the bill would require the trade association to hold a separate additional license, either an off-premises retail license or a temporary sales license, in order to obtain the wine shipper permit. Now, the bill already provides that the holder of an off-premises retail license can apply for the wine shipper permit, so the provision allowing a trade association that holds an off-premises retail license is simply superfluous. In addition, the bill would allow a trade association to apply for the shipper permit if it holds a temporary sales license. But this really isn't a practical option because a temporary sales license is only issued for special events lasting only a day or two, which means that the temporary sales license and the permit would basically expire before any wine could actually be shipped. The TSL license already allows retail sales of bottles to go, so there really doesn't seem to be a need for a wine shipper permit at special events. In addition, to be eligible for the shipper permit, the trade association may be comprised of a single winery, multiple wineries, other entities from anywhere in the country, and it doesn't need to have any Oregon members under Section 2 of the bill. The only requirement is that it hold the other licenses previously mentioned. But in general, a winery association cannot obtain either a retail off-premises license or a temporary sales license due to the statutory tied house restrictions, which Jesse Lyons alluded to, which preclude an association of wholesalers from holding a retail license. Similar tied house laws are common in other states, which makes it unlikely the trade association could obtain the licenses needed to qualify for the shipper permit. Section 4 of the bill creates an exception from Oregon's tied house law for certain types of winery trade associations, but not all of the associations that are described in Section 2 of the bill. It's not clear to us why the tied house exception in Section 4 is only available to certain trade associations, but the wine shipper eligibility under Section 2 is not similarly limited. But in any event, the tied house exception is only available to a trade association that's comprised primarily of Oregon wineries, and it's not clear what other legal issues this limitation might cause. Our primary concern is that the tied house exception is not only for wine shipper permits. The bill grants a broad exception from all tied house provisions, which means that in addition to obtaining a wine shipper permit, a trade association could obtain a permanent retail license for on-premises or off-premises sales. As Jesse Lyons mentioned, one of the reasons we believe that trade associations were included in this bill is because these groups have been unable to obtain temporary sales licenses to promote their wine at festivals and other special events in Oregon. We believe that a broad exception to the tied house laws is not necessary to allow trade associations to participate in these events along with Oregon wineries. This could be accomplished through limited modification to the temporary sales license statute and the tied house laws to allow trade associations simply to obtain the temporary sales license for these special events. In fact, another bill, House Bill 2168, to amend the temporary sales license statute in other ways, is currently pending before this committee and could be utilized for this purpose. In summary, we believe that the inclusion of trade associations in this bill raises a number of technical issues and is not necessary to achieve the objectives of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And some people think water law is confusing. I need a flow chart for everybody to testify today.
that my eyes are glazing over. And because I'm painfully honest, and I don't mind admitting it, there's a lot going on here, and I am utter. If I wasn't confused before I came in here today, I am utterly confused now. So, with all that editorializing and confessing, are there any questions for these fine people today?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We voted for this as a committee bill.
Yeah, well, we submitted it as a committee bill. All right. Well, if there are no questions, thank you very much. And I do have a request for you. I want a flow chart of who can sell, who can't, in, out, and what happens if they sell to a minor, and what amount they can sell. Because, you know, if I'm out there, big retailer in Kansas or Illinois, I'm not that, you know, people can say, well, then I don't sell. If I'm busted, there's nothing we can do about it in state law. We'll just go sell somewhere else. I'm not convinced that they are that indifferent. I think they're very interested in the market here. So I want all that information and for all these bills. So this is very complex. With all that, thank you very much. And does anyone else want to come up here and add any clarity to House Bill 2488 today? All right, I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2488. And I'm going to skip out of queue here because we have some two representatives here. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2170. And Representative Kotek and Representative Dinkfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative for House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. And thank you for the opportunity to express some concerns today about House Bill 2170. As it is being presented, I'm here to oppose the bill. For those of you who don't know my district, I represent most of North Portland and parts of Northeast Portland, residential areas that range anywhere from St. John's neighborhood to the Cully neighborhood. And you will hear from some of my constituents and actually Representative Dinkfelder's constituents. We jointly represent the Cully neighborhood, and some neighbors from that neighborhood are here today from Portland. We represent neighborhoods that routinely deal with difficulties in livability that arise from liquor dispensing establishments, so that's why we're here. I oppose 2170 because I think it's too broad and will disadvantage my constituents' ability to protect and or improve the livability of their neighborhoods. While business interests and economic development are important considerations, the mission of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is, quote, to promote the public interest through the responsible sales and service of alcoholic beverages, unquote. I believe this mission includes providing a fair and meaningful opportunity for neighbors to participate in the liquor license application process. Many of my neighbors and their respective neighborhood associations already feel that the existing process is slanted toward business owners. House Bill 2170, by granting temporary authority first for dispensing and then basically asking questions later, puts neighbors at a disadvantage. With the proposed changes, a coffee shop next door to your house could turn into a full-service bar practically overnight. I take issue with the argument that the proposed process is better because it will allow a business to dispense as sort of a test run, thus allowing proprietors to show neighbors what kind of establishment they will be while still giving neighbors an opportunity to assert their opinion before an actual license is granted. I disagree with the argument that it is easier to revoke a temporary authority as opposed to an actual liquor license. Although this may be true technically, I fear it will not be true in practice. This bill encourages the OLCC to operate in a way that is convenient for business but not necessarily for neighborhood livability. When a neighbor sees a new establishment pouring liquor, they do not see a temporary authority, and they do not see a chance to engage in the process of giving their input to the OLCC. This bill will diminish the weight of neighbors' input and preclude many of them from giving any input at all. At minimum, I urge you to remove the new restaurants, bars, or tavern applicants from this change. Shouldn't new establishments in our city and in other places and around the state have to prove their ability to survive a few months without selling alcohol before granting them the authority to dispense? House Bill 2170 is terribly flawed from the perspective of preserving true citizen input and protecting neighborhood livability. And I urge you to oppose it, and I will thank you for your time, and then pass it over to Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. Jackie Dingfelder, State Representative, House District 45, and I represent that other part of Northeast Portland that Representative Kotek mentioned. Our districts are actually nested together, and we both happen to share one neighborhood, Cully neighborhood, which has the highest density of liquor establishments in Northeast Portland. The reason I'm here is for many of the similar reasons that you've heard from Representative Kotek. I won't repeat. We had some very similar and overlapping concerns. I will just add a couple things, and their testimony is also, my testimony is also in front of you. As I mentioned, the main concern is that for areas that already have a high density of liquor establishment, like our neighborhoods, this House Bill 2170 has the potential to increase that number. And like Representative Kotek, I'm especially concerned about the specific part of the bill that talks about extending the temporary period for new establishments. I see no reason to change the current law with regard to new restaurants or bars. These places do not possess any special need to obtain a temporary letter and should continue to go through the liquor licensing process that applicants must submit to now. And I'm doubling the temporary letter time from 90 to 180 days is valid that it serves the business interests, but I question how it will serve residents' interests. This, as far as allowing liquor license applicants to operate immediately, this is the central concern that I've heard from constituents. Several constituents have written to explain how House Bill 2170 has the possibility of negatively impacting their neighborhoods and neighborhood livability. One example given by a constituent has to do with good neighbor agreements, and these are usually created during the liquor license application process, and it's in essence a negotiation with the owner of an establishment that OLCC facilitates, and this agreement gives the business a better understanding of what's expected from it in order to be a good neighbor. So a business, I find it hard to imagine why a business would be motivated to engage in a good neighbor agreement if it's already allowed to serve liquor. And many of the concerns that I've heard about this bill reflect the constituents' concern that the bill may limit the neighborhood's ability to use this tool to maintain livability. So I'm sure a lot of the concerns that Representative Kotek raised. I've heard from many constituents that they have oppositions to this bill, and unfortunately I think the way it's written now, we won't necessarily be able to protect the livability of some of our especially more urban neighborhoods. And so I urge your opposition to this, or to consider rethinking some of the parts of this bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I just have one question. How could this preclude someone being involved in the process of denying these folks a license? How could we hamper a resident's ability to be involved in this process by extending this timeline and allowing for a temporary letter of authority of a new business?
Chair Schossler, thank you for the question. I think one of the things I was interested in this bill, and then I'll answer your question, is I'm not sure what problem we're trying to solve here. I know there's some concern about businesses somehow being surprised and shocked that they have to wait so long once they open a business to get a liquor license. You know, if they're doing a good business plan, they should be prepared for that. And again, like I mentioned, if it's a restaurant or a bar, we want to see that they're actually something beyond just a place to go get a drink. They should be viable establishments beyond serving alcohol. In terms of how this would be difficult for public process is, if I recall from reading the notes from the previous hearing, the way it would work is that a lot of these applications already get granted. And I think it makes it even a higher bar. It's more difficult to take something away once it's been granted than making it a reward to apply for a liquor license application, be a good, act into a good neighbor agreement, and then 90 days or it's currently 90 days, I believe, then you have that liquor license granted. That's, you know, once you, I think, give somebody something, a temporary authority, it's much more difficult to take it away from them. And I don't have any, you know, scientific proof of that. I just think that puts the onus, that makes it even more difficult for a neighbor to go in and say, look, they're having problems with this person. And where a lot of people say, well, there's no problem at all. When I think there should be an upfront proof that, you know, I can be a good neighbor before I get my liquor license. I think it's just how you go about it.
And Chair Schauffler, I would ask you to repeat that question. We have many constituents that came here today to testify so you can hear their stories directly.
Right.
And both Representative Kotek and I have been working with this neighborhood association, and I have to say they have been working tirelessly on this issue. They also won the Spirit of Portland award recently, and they are really trying hard to make sure that their neighborhood is clearly a livable place in the city of Portland. And the concerns that I've heard is that this process, first of all, it's because it's a state process within a city, it's a difficult process to negotiate. I have talked to many of my neighborhood associations who have challenges working with the OLCC because it's a state process. At the same time, there's a local city process going on for siting of these, you know, building permits, this establishments. And I think that we at the state could do a better job of working with our neighborhoods and working with the cities to make sure that this process runs smoother as well.
And Representative, there's no end to what we can improve at the state level, I'm sure, working with our communities. And I don't want to in any way minimize the work of your constituents in keeping their neighborhoods livable. If I got it right, I believe I can go buy a tavern that's already running, and that license remains intact until I'm checked out, even though I've purchased the entity. And the logic, I think, is if I go out and buy a new one, build a new one from the ground up, why can't I hit the ground running? I think that's the logic. And correct me if I'm wrong, but don't get me wrong. I'm all for people maintaining the livability of their community, and I'm certainly not opposed to that. And if there are any bad players out there, if there are any people that aren't being good neighbors, if they are serving alcohol to people that shouldn't be consuming it, then they should have their license removed. I don't think there's anyone in this building that disagrees with that. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for inviting us up here. And I think the stories you will hear will speak for themselves, actually.
And Chair Schauffler, I think you're correct. If you're buying an existing business,
right,
you get a temporary authority to basically transfer that liquor license. But there's an expectation. People know that there was a business there that was serving.
Right.
So it's no big surprise.
I think you have some more questions, though.
Okay.
Representative.
Sorry.
Escobar.
Well, I have a question to maybe my fellow legislators. Didn't we pass through the House some fast track on OLCC license where they paid an extra fee or something like that last session?
I think it got vetoed.
Oh, okay. Well, I knew we did it in the House.
That's right. All right. Any other questions from our esteemed, wonderful colleagues?
Representative Berger.
I understand concerns of neighbors with a new restaurant going in or establishment that serves liquor. That is a legitimate neighborhood concern. But it seems to me that at the outset, if the neighbors understand that liquor is going to be served, extending this period gives them more of a chance to weigh in, not less. In other words, by extending this temporary permit, it gives them more of a chance to weigh in. And in fact, under the liquor control testimony, it says this temporary authority can act as a provisional license, giving the commission, local government, and neighbors an opportunity to assess the applicant and their operation before issuing what really is a more permanent license. And I guess, would you speak to that?
Chair Schauffler, Representative Berger, I think that's a good question. I think Representative Dingfelder's suggestion of hearing from the neighbors, they're in the trenches dealing with the liquor license applications. And, I think that's certainly one way to look at it. I think it's just that sense that once you provide that temporary authority, that it's almost like a fait accompli, that I would be very surprised if then at that point, if you were having issues, that you could really stop that from license from happening. And I think that's from my personal experience working in neighborhoods, that, you know, there's a very high bar to keep that license from ever happening under the current process. And so you add this extra, well, let's start serving and then, you know, prove us wrong. I don't know. It just strikes me as a stronger barrier to stopping something that might not be good for the neighborhood.
Again, I will defer to you. We'll hear some stories. I know we have some people here who would like to testify, so I want to make sure that they have time. You have time to hear their stories and appreciate your consideration.
Any other questions? All right, thanks a lot. I'm just going to continue on here and call. We're going to hear from the opponents first today. Kathy Fuerstani? Okay, all right, I'm doing my best. And Mel Vietsky? And Don McGillivray.
Yeah.
Please. And then we'll hear from the proponents at the end, so they can come and defend their case if they are up to it. And just so you know, this is the second hearing, and I had this down for a work session today, and we may work this bill today. We didn't hear any opposition in the initial public hearing.
And
I
you
just
know why the
share
reason for that is?
No, ma'am.
I got a notification that this was being heard on Friday, that it was being heard on Monday, so it's really very short notice for me.
Would you identify yourself?
Yes. My name is Kathy Fuerstanel, and
I'm Kathy, before you get going, you heard about this hearing on Friday.
No, not this hearing. The first one that you alluded to, that there was no opposition.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't aware there was a hearing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we did have 72-hour notice for that and every other bill we've heard in this committee, because that's the rules.
Right, from Friday to Monday.
No, ma'am. Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
The initial hearing was posted and a 72-hour notice.
Okay.
And then this one was posted with 48-hour notice.
No, actually, Mr. Chair, this was posted 72
Forgive
hours
me.
As well. So.
This was posted with 72 hours notice as well. So.
Right, I got on
Thank
the
you.
List.
Go ahead.
All right. So my name is Kathy Fuerstanel, and I want to thank you today for giving us the opportunity to speak regarding House Bill 2170. I have been the chair of the Cully Association of Neighbors for the past 2.5 years and have had many liquor license applications come across my desk. If you look at the front page of the attached June 2005 draft provided by the City of Portland Bureau of Planning, it shows the number of liquor outlets per district totaling 1,989, while the back page clearly illustrates the shocking figure for the Northeast area. The total number of liquor outlets since has increased to 2,100 in 2007. The Cully neighborhood has the most liquor licenses in the Northeast Portland district. House Bill 2170 would encourage more liquor outlets to open, creating even more saturation and problems for many neighborhoods if applicants are allowed to receive a 180-day temporary letter of authority while applications are being processed. The Cully neighborhood currently has 36 businesses that hold a liquor license and 4 applications in review. One of the pending businesses has a city code violation against them and is not permitted to open for business. When this was brought to the attention of the OLCC, they felt that it was a city code inspection matter and had no bearing on the liquor license application request. So it would seem that under House Bill 2170, this establishment would still be granted a temporary license to serve liquor for 180 days. 2 years ago, 2 liquor license applications were submitted for a new business on a single site that previously held a restaurant that had been a haven for drugs, violence, and prostitution, and was finally closed to the relief of the neighborhood. The first application on this location was for an establishment for a full bar and restaurant with lottery machines, while the other would feature a full bar and adult entertainment. Both of these businesses were owned by the same owner with different family managers. Last year, after a thorough investigation, the OLCC actually denied the first application, a surprise and a rarity. The second established then withdrew their application. The OLCC decision for denial resulted after receiving, reviewing, and investigating input and data from neighbors, the police bureau, and the Cully area legislators about this problem site. Several months later, the Cully Association was informed that the manager, who was denied a liquor license, appealed the OLCC decision. The OLCC met privately with the manager and his lawyer to discuss restrictions that would allow him to receive a liquor license. The Cully Association was not allowed to attend this meeting. It is my understanding that the manager presented the OLCC a draft of a good neighbor agreement between the Neighborhood Association and the manager that was created before the denial. Upon agreeing to the OLCC restrictions, the liquor license was approved. I mean, at what point does the neighborhood get heard? A denial is a denial and should be upheld. Otherwise, why go through any process, especially when the final process occurs without any transparency? Without liquor license now in hand, the manager has now decided that his restaurant will be serving only the required amount of limited food items to serve beer and wine and make money from his 5 lottery machines. So I wondered whatever happened that a business can be self-sufficient without depending on lottery money as well. If House Bill 217 passes, then all the businesses, not the change of ownership or renewal applications, would be able to dispense liquor during the investigation period for 180 days. It is unfair to neighbors to allow an establishment to serve a liquor before causes for denial are received and investigated. I would imagine that the business manager who previously withdrew their application and whose building has not been leased to anyone else would resubmit their liquor application, and if this bill were to pass, would get their temporary letter of authority. Thinking that an establishment will be on its best behavior during the temporary license period is unreasonable. Seldom does a liquor license ever get revoked, so why would a business be concerned about it once they are permitted to start serving? Police Commander Michael Krebs of East Precinct in Portland has stated in an email to the Office of Neighborhood Involvement regarding House Bill 217 that he thinks, quote, that this is a bad idea. They should wait until they pass everything before selling any alcohol. A lot of bad things can happen in 6 months, end quote. The licensing review period is a critical time for neighborhood associations to work with business owners and residents to reach an accord to promote a healthy business climate and livable neighborhood. Good neighbor agreements that are created before this period are an important opportunity to provide comment before a business starts serving alcohol. Without a working relationship between business and residents, the livability of the neighborhood would be greatly threatened. Once a business is allowed to serve alcohol, they most likely will not have any desire to have this dialogue, and then the OLCC, in the interest of revenue, will grant their permanent license as they have been doing. Do we really want to live in a society that isn't heard, where our ideas and comments are disregarded? I do not think so. Neighborhood associations play a vital role in the livability of a neighborhood. The Cully Association of Neighbors is the 2006 Spirit of Portland Neighborhood Association winner. We are awarded this honor in part due to our neighborhood involvement and partnerships for positive changes in our communities. Allowing liquor licenses to receive temporary letters of authority undermines the association's ability to maintain a livable neighborhood with these businesses. Please join the Central Northeast Neighbors Coalition, who voted not to support this bill, and vote no on House Bill 2170. Thank you, Chairman, Representative, and committee members, for your consideration.
Thank you.
Go ahead, sir.
My name is Mel Vitsky. I am a board member of the Cully Association of Neighbors, and I'm here to ask you to vote no on HB 2170. We don't have a well-paid lobbyist to represent us, but we do expect the OLCC to do its job of representing the best interests of the citizens of the state and the neighborhoods. You are not doing your job unless you give equal consideration to the concerns of the citizens of our state. At this time, the Cully neighborhood is saturated with liquor outlets. Within a few blocks of the Rigler and Harvey Scott's Elementary School, there are 8 liquor outlets, 4 of which are bars. 2 of those bars are topless dancer bars. If you approve HB 2170, you will encourage even more saturation in our neighborhood. No liquor license should be issued without adequate time to consider the neighborhood's thoughts and opinions. We don't need or want a fast-track licensing process, and HB 21 will do just that. Would you let someone build a house and then, after a family moved in, have it inspected to see if it has a foundation and was built to code? I don't think so. Don't give out a liquor license without giving time and consideration to all reasonable input. We are asking that you vote no on House Bill 2170. I would like to, if I could, give a little story about something that happened in our neighborhood. If that would be okay?
Please, go ahead.
There was a bar named The Backswing. This bar had open drug use in the parking lot, open drug sales in the establishment. It had prostitution openly with the dancers. It had a shooting and a murder in its parking lot, and it had another shooting after that where a man was chased down the street and shot two or three times, and finally the police got there, and he only stopped because of blood loss. He passed out from losing blood. Even after all of that, you would not suspend the liquor license of that bar. Now, what makes you think that we would believe that you're going to give a temporary license and you would suspend it when you wouldn't do it with a bar that had drug use? And many police officers complained, Portland police officers complained, and we still could not get the license suspended. I don't understand it, and I don't expect that if they have a temporary license that it will ever be revoked. And that I want to thank you for letting us speak and represent our neighborhood. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Don McGilvery, and I live in the Buckman neighborhood and have been active in the Buckman Community Association for 30 years, and I'm a past chair of that organization. Again, my experiences with OLCC from the neighborhood perspective have been very challenging, and I have pretty much retired from that endeavor, but there's many people on the association that still are active. Basically, we review probably 6 to 8 liquor licenses, applications for liquor licenses each year, and sometimes more than that. We also, in the last 10 years, have had people on the board of directors that own restaurants and businesses with liquor licenses, so we are familiar with them through that experience. And again, I'd like to say that most liquor licensees basically are just fine. They're good people, and they operate, you know, good or businesses and whatever. But again, we have had our serious challenges. We have also had a murder in one of these establishments called the Warehouse. And it was basically, once again, there was no satisfaction from dealing with OLCC in the matter. They would not refute. They would not deny the license. And again, this is somewhat rare. But again, when neighborhood reviews things, you have to essentially, assume the worst case, and then proceed from there. And the other thing is that if it is a bad situation, you're not going to be able to deal with it. Again, this is, I'd like to read a letter from Michael Wolfson. He has three liquor licenses in the inner southeast area. Four. Anyhow, this is to the governor. My name is Michael Wolfson, and I am writing on behalf of the Buckman Community Association, a group that represents a large, beautiful neighborhood of working-class families in the heart of southeast Portland's southeast side. I'm writing to voice strong opposition to the OLCC's proposed abolition of the waiting period required for new liquor outlet applicants. As a multiple licensee and community representative, I can state unequivocally that the waiting period is neither egregious nor antiquated. Requiring an applicant to wait until the license investigation is completed is prudent for both the community and the applicant, as it will give each time to thoroughly integrate their aims and goals into a cohesive vision for all involved. Removing the waiting period will cause great difficulty for community members who feel abandoned by a state agency that already feels like a prohibition-era throwback to most. Please consider moving strongly against this proposal. Sincerely, Michael A. Wolfson.
Thank you. Representative Berger, you have a question? Or, excuse me, Esquivel.
Not a question. It's just more of a statement. I came from a city government. I'm sorry that your city isn't helping you. There are nuisance ordinances where you could shut this thing down in a heartbeat. And I'm surprised that your city hasn't come forth to help you. I know if we had a bar that had a history of what you just said, we in our city, we'd have that thing shut down. Because you can pull their business license and put them out of business.
There was something that I didn't state, and I didn't think to say. I mean, I forgot about it. I was interested in letting you know what had happened to us. The only reason that that bar ever closed after all that was because they had an electrical fire. And that bar was closed for 2 years. We did not want another bar there because the owners before that we had problems. After 2 years, they have been, now they have a new business there. Now these people seem to be in good behavior and we haven't had a problem. They haven't been open not very long, but they seem to be doing a pretty good job.
But they did come to our meeting and
they came to our meeting, they asked us what, and we told them what we expected of them and they agreed to that. And that has been a pretty good relationship to this point. But we need help from you. When we have these kinds of problems, it is your duty to see that that person is not rewarded by keeping their license, no matter what the city does.
Sir, I just want to make it very clear to you and everyone listening. Everyone up here, and there's no one up here who supports drug peddling, illicit drug consumption, prostitution, or any continuance of that anywhere.
Right.
I want to make you very clear to you that we're opposed to that, and we're not rewarding anyone for that kind of behavior. Representative Berger, did you have a question?
I will when you're done, Mr.
I'm,
Chair.
I'm finished.
Let me characterize what I'm hearing from you. You folks are suffering from some very real problems in your neighborhoods, and I applaud you for your activism on its behalf. The bill before us, however, if I could characterize it, your fundamental problem with it is that you don't trust OLCC to make this extension of the temporary to be anything but a permanent license. In other words, it's your trust that the OLC, because my point to the representatives who spoke before us was that, in theory at least, by extending this temporary, it would actually give the neighborhood more time to talk to OLCC and themselves and everybody else rather than less before a permanent license is issued. But I think I hear from you folks that you have had such a bad experience here that you don't trust even a temporary license to be temporary. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes.
And I am quite sympathetic to your perspective on this because it sounds like you have had neighborhood issues that are quite egregious. We're left with the bill before us, however, that doesn't solve all problems, but does try to address a specific one in a specific way. And I really thank you for coming and talking to us.
My experience with OLCC is that it is not a regulatory body. It is basically a marketing body or a promotion body for the sale of alcoholic beverages in the state of Oregon. And therefore, to appeal to them is almost hopeless.
Any more questions? Representative Rosenbaum, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And good to see you, Mr. McGilvery. I want to just point out that this problem is not restricted to certain neighborhoods in North or Northeast Portland because my district also. I probably have more complaints in this area than I do about almost anything else in terms of neighborhood livability issues. And I just want to say, you know, I went back and read the testimony that we originally got on this bill, and it talks about the need to do this for economic development. And I think what you're being asked to weigh here is that versus people in these neighborhoods, you know, good, hardworking people who really are trying to have a place where they can live peacefully, raise their families, and very often just feel extremely frustrated. I think that's what we're hearing from your testimony today about just not being able to make a dent on a process. And so to take a temporary license and extend it, double it basically, I think is a pretty painful pill when people are already feeling like they're not able to effectively put limits on the places in their neighborhood. So I hear what you're saying.
Could I just make a comment?
Absolutely.
Thank you. I think the neighborhood, especially when there's been a problem site in the past, and then a new established one to open on that same province site, to go ahead and allow them to just start serving liquor just as soon as their application is submitted is wrong, because the neighborhood should have an opportunity to address the problems that were there previously on that site and talk to the owner and talk with OLCC and give input without having the establishment already serving the liquor.
Any other questions? You know, I be honest with you, I don't think it's a time period for allowing a license. I don't think it's a license issue. I think it's our ability or lack of ability put the hammer down on bad people. And that's why when you all go back and take your seats, I'm going to ask Mr. Perry to come up and talk about this bill. And I'm going to ask the Liquor Control Commission if they're prepared to respond to anything that's been said here today, to talk about how we do put the hammer down on bad actors. And with all due respect, there's always two sides to every story. Mm-hmm. And well, once again, I am confident that no one here or at the Liquor Control Commission is in any way, shape, or form interested or condoning or encouraging drug use, drug sale, prostitution, or any other bad illegal behavior here in the state of Oregon. And I'm interested to hear them respond to how they respond or lack of response to you all. So with that, thank you very much. I appreciate your time and effort. And Mr. Perry, would you come on up? And are the staff people from Liquor Control Commission prepared to come up and respond to some of these things today? Because I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about specifically about this neighborhood and their challenges. Mr. Perry, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm with the Oregon Restaurant Association. First, I want to start with this bill did not necessarily come from the OLCC. It came from the task force. Mm-hmm. And on this task force, they tried to abide by consensus as much as they could. What they did is they had kind of three groups, OLCC, the industry, and the city's neighborhood associations. And no policy or bill could get out with more than two no votes. So there was a Portland Neighborhood Association, ONI, City of Portland Police, and League of Oregon Cities were all on the task force that approved this bill. And so I wasn't there. There was another representative from our association. So obviously it didn't get more than two no votes. So this was well vetted over, obviously, the bill you spoke about earlier, the TPM bill. There were a bunch of components involved in it. They tried to deal with each one of the individual components as it dealt with it. So this came through a long vetted process. Now, to be clear, too, it came up about the new licensee versus the old license, or a new licensee versus a buying existing. Okay, if I buy a grocery store or a bar as just an individual, I get a temporary. If I build a grocery store, I get a temporary. But if I build a bar, I don't. I just think there's some inequities there. And so when we're talking about liquor licensees, some of these are off-premise, some are on. The coffee shop that was brought up earlier, if the coffee shop wants to sell wine by the bottle, they can get a temporary. If they want to sell it by the glass, they can't. I mean, I think a lot more is being made out of it than it is today. There's also a comment about you're extending the time period, and I would argue that isn't true. Because as of right now, if you want to go to Portland and get a liquor license, the time frame has shrunk down. It used to be about 120 days. Now it's getting closer to 90. But if you look at the existing bill, it talks about it removes 90 and puts in 180. But down on lines 10 and 11, what it removes is it says, if the process isn't complete, the director can extend 30-day temporaries. So what's happening today is they're extending temporaries on these 120-day applications. But the people involved, whether it's the city, the neighborhood association, or anybody else, is trying to rush to meet that 90. And so today you can get a 180-day temporary if all the basically processes haven't met, you're just extending it. So I don't think it's an extension of the time period. Also, if you look down into 15, 16, and 17, they could deny it temporary. Everybody that gets out there does not get a temporary, and I will guarantee you if somebody's got some sort of a violation on their record, my dealings with the OLCC, they're most likely not going to grant them a temporary license. But the problem with it is if I go up and apply for a license, on paper, I probably look okay. Handling, selling food, I probably look okay. But managing alcohol is a different process. You know, it just is. And I would just say, under this process, I'm given a test period. I'm given a 180-day test period. And if I don't manage it appropriately, I mean, you can look at liquor licenses today. They get limitations. They get denied. But if you've never seen me before as the OLCC and I hand you my resume and it looks fine, you're generally going to give me a license. Well, it's, you know, I don't care what you say, it's a lot harder to revoke a license that's been granted. Even if you don't revoke a temporary, I know at the end of 180 days, if I've been a bad actor, my chances of not getting a license are drastically increased. And I will just say that you can ask my members, they don't think they're a marketing entity. They think they're a regulatory entity. You know, I can give you stories about how different restaurateurs have been impacted through minors in possession and anything else. And I will say that if any licensee violates a law, they actually violate a law. I don't care if it's a city, county, or state. If it's been adjudicated and they have a penalty against them, it will count against their liquor license. I will say there are issues where the court system has not adjudicated them. They just said, we're not going to do anything. Well, it's not OLCC's job to try all crimes. It's their job to say, okay, where have you violated the law? If you violated the law, we're going to penalize you, but we don't have to go out and retest every case from a city or county or anything else. It's not their job to do that. It's the city's job to show where you've broken the law. You tell the OLCC, and I can guarantee you the OLCC will count it against me when I come up for license renewal. But you see a lot of these things that happen in downtown Portland, they're not being adjudicated. And, you know, is it really the OLCC's responsibility to go through the process of being the trial and jury and adjudicator of a law that's not theirs? And that's a lot of times where the process falls. And I'm not blaming the court system. They're sitting there going, well, I got a liquor violation or some, you know, property crime. They're making a choice like we all are. I mean, they're trying to decide how to spend their time. So I would just say that I don't think this extends the time period. It gets away, does away with the 30-day temporary extensions. And it just says 180 days. That means that everybody's not trying to meet that 90-day test and then getting 30-day extensions when then they're scrambling to extend their period. It gives everybody a general idea how long it is. And I would argue that you can't sit there and go, let them operate as a restaurant. Because I can tell you, as a fine dining restaurant, I'm not going to open up if I can't serve wine. I mean, because you just don't want a customer come for a nice meal and then not serve them wine because they will remember it and not come back. If I'm predominantly a bar business, I'm not going to open up because it's not really the customer that I'm going after. So really what you want to do is open up and allow the citizens, the OLCC, and everything else to see, can I manage the specific issues around alcohol? It's different than a McDonald's or a lunch bar. There are specific issues that are unrelated to food service that are related to alcohol, and you're better giving them a test period, if they choose to take it, than you are just sitting there going, okay, let me look at your resume, and after that I'll grant you a license. So I'd like to back up and say one more time, off-premise gets a temporary, whether they're buying an existing business or starting a new one. On-premise, meaning restaurants, bars, and taverns, only get it if they're buying an existing business. So there's an inequity right there. There are some people who can build a business from the ground up and have the process today where others can't. And I can really only apply for the license after I've got my property foot plan and everything else. So I've built my business. Now it just sits there for 90 days until you grant me a liquor license. So there is a financial issue as it relates to bars that off-premise, meaning grocery stores or convenience stores, don't have to deal with today. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Perry today? All right, again, thank you very much. Can I get the commission to come up and respond to some of this, please? I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dan McNeil. I'm the Metro Licensing Unit Manager for Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I testified previously in support of this bill. We've heard a lot of testimony today, and a lot of it gets down to details, which I don't have at hand. I can talk generally about our processes and the things that we look at, and I appreciate the chair specifically when he said that none of us are in support of unlawful activity. None of us want to have, we don't want minors served. We don't want drunks served. We don't want fights. We don't want gunshots at licensed taverns and bars. And ultimately, we're not an agency that makes great revenue off of licensing bad bars. I mean, that's not where our agency comes in and not the mission that we have. In fact, our mission is very clear in looking at public safety issues. And there are laws that we have to apply. And some of those laws are very specific, things like you can't sell alcohol to a minor or somebody that's visibly intoxicated. Some of them are very general. And some of those that we look at in licensing have to do with those very issues that we were discussing right here. One of the issues that we deal with is neighborhood livability. There's a law that talks about neighborhood livability issues. It says that OLCC can deny a license if there's a history of serious and persistent problems at the business with noise, fights, disorderly activity. And those were one of the things that we would consider before we ever made a decision to approve a temporary authority under this bill. And that's something that we look at right now and take very, very seriously. If there's a potential basis to refuse a license, the OLCC does have the authority to not issue that temporary authority that we're talking about here. And we can also revoke that authority if we see that there's a potential basis to refuse it, if we have reasonable grounds to believe that there's a basis to refuse. So there is protection allowed in the law that we obviously are very concerned about and that we do use. And currently, those businesses that do qualify for temporary authorities, if there are violations of OLCC laws, we see somebody that sells minors to minors a couple times during their operation that are temporary, the OLCC will act and revoke that temporary authority. If there's other problems, we recently revoked an authority where there was a restriction on the license that said the person that operated the business could not sell products that contributed to street drinking in the area. These are like your fortified wines and some of your high alcohol content beers. The person was operating under a temporary authority and started selling those products in violation of that authority. We acted immediately to revoke that authority. So we do take those issues seriously. Now, like any regulatory agency, we have to deal very, very carefully with our business owners because we have to establish that when we take an action that we have the facts to support that. So you may get a complaint that there's drug dealing going on at a business, and we'll certainly look into that. But ultimately, we have to work with local police to establish that activity is happening, that we have proof of that when it's happening, who's doing that. We have to establish that it was something that somebody was aware of and had knowledge of. And those things take a lot of investigation and time, and when we have the information before us, we do act to cite the person for a violation. We also do have a progressive penalty schedule, and that progressive penalty schedule calls for violations to be assessed at certain levels and for repeated violations during a two-year period of time. The violation could result in license suspension or license cancellation or just a fine depending on the nature of that. And for very serious violations, the penalty may be license cancellation for a first offense. So generally, we do have a scheme that works well with that. We do work very closely with the local government. We work very closely with local police to address the issues that come before us. And it's not our goal to keep bad businesses in business. We really do try to take the appropriate action when we have reports of problems. And if you have specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yeah, obviously, if a licensee knowingly sells drugs or allows to sell contraband or prostitution or sells to minors or intoxicated people, clearly they're revoked. What if there is a problem? Let's say there's a tavern, Joe's Place, and the owner is a legitimate business person, decent person, tries to uphold the law, but it's just in a neighborhood or in a place where they just got bad demographics there, and it's a repeated problem in the neighborhood where there are all these bad things going on. What do you do in that case? Do you allow that business to stay open, or after so many complaints, so many problems, so many adjudicated problems on or off the premises, what do you do?
Well, that's a very good question, Chairman. What we have on the compliance end is the same law that talks about a history of serious and persistent problems at a business also applies for us either taking action to cancel or suspend a license as well. So almost the exact same language as we have on the licensing end is that the commission can cancel a license if there's a history of serious and persistent problems. And those problems can either be problems that happen at the place of business, right, actually within their four walls, or in the immediate vicinity of the business if we can establish that it's their patrons that are involved in those unlawful activities, fights and disturbances. So when we have those kind of activities that we're able to document and show that it's a patron of the tavern and it's happening outside and that those activities continue, our first step, of course, is not to cancel the license the first time we get a report, but to work with the licensee. We make sure that they're aware of the problem. We work to see if they can adopt a control plan. It may require them to hire security people to patrol that area and make sure that they're looking out for problems and being very proactive. But if they adopt those measures and those measures are ultimately ineffective, the license does get canceled.
Okay, I have one more question and I'm going to open it up to committee because I'm going to be honest, I'm inclined to pass this out. But what about when a neighborhood association, and we've heard a lot of anecdotal, although I believe sincere and honest testimony here today about problems in neighborhoods. I want you to respond to the allegations that you all don't respond in a timely fashion, that you ignore the concerns of people in neighborhoods and ignore neighborhood associations' concerns, and everything we heard from these folks right here. I want you to respond to that, please.
And I would say we do not ignore neighborhood concerns, and we do the best job we can of trying to find out if there's documentation. We get a lot of anecdotal information in the licensing process, and things that when we're told to respect the opinions of neighbors, a lot of times what we get in the licensing process is opinion. We don't think there should be another bar or tavern here without reference to specific problems that we can document. City of Portland specifically does a very good job. The local police bureau has a crime reporting system where they run crime stats, and we're able to pull those up. If we get complaints that there are problems in the area, we pull the crime stats to see what exactly are the police responding to. Are these issues that are related to alcohol? Will this business contribute to those problems? And part of the process of licensing is also working with the applicant, because they may be able to establish that their business is one that won't contribute to problems, even if there are some level of problems. If there's a very high level of problems, of course, that burden gets much higher for them to establish that they won't contribute to those problems. But we deal with all kinds of businesses. Some businesses are simple businesses like sushi bars, where the sale of alcohol is a very small piece of their business, and ultimately they're not going to contribute to problems. When you're talking about a business opening up a bar or tavern or nightclub, that burden is much higher. They need to establish for us that they have a security plan that's going to work, that they may have to make changes to their proposed hours of operation. They may have to hire, you know, certain staffing for certain periods of time, like have certain security staff to show that they can run their business properly. And that's before that we'll approve that license for them. And those same processes would continue under this proposal. Legislation.
Representative Escobar, you have a question.
I don't have. Yes, I do actually. What it is when do you still allow city councils to weigh in on applications and or reapps, and they check the individual out, see if there's any criminal back activity within not only the premise but also the individual and the owners or the managers, and then they in turn have a public hearing on it and make a recommendation and forward it to OLCC for consideration?
We do have that process, and that's every year when licenses renew. The local government has a 60-day period in which to make a recommendation on the licenses in their jurisdiction that are renewing. Before we issue a license, currently local governments have 45 days to review that license application and make a recommendation. The one distinction is that it is a recommendation. The law sets out the responsibility for making the decision on the liquor license with OLCC, and we have to apply very specifically the statutes that the legislature has passed that give us our authority on granting or denying licenses. So we have to work very carefully within those bounds. We always take it very seriously when we get a denial recommendation from the local government. It doesn't mean that we can always honor that request for denial from the local government, but our Board of Commissioners are the ones that ultimately make the decision when we get an unfavorable from the local government.
Representative Edwards.
Two questions. What is the role of OLCC in regulating the density of of liquor serving establishments in a neighborhood. I heard a lot of discussion about saturation of a neighborhood. Do you consider that, or do you just look at that individual operator, and if they're one block from another establishment that's just like them, that's one block from another that's just like them? Do you not consider that? Do you consider that?
Right. Currently, we don't have any standards that deal with saturation. There's a very broad statute that says that the Liquor Commission could deny a license. It's not based on public interest or convenience. Previously, when OLCC tried to apply that statute, we were taken to court and told that, no, that statute by itself was much too broad an authority for us to base a decision on. We've had a lot of discussions, and, in fact, the committee that forwarded this recommendation was actually a subcommittee of participants looking at saturation problem areas, two issues that we frequently have to deal with.
Follow-up?
Yes, Representative Edwards, please.
If you don't consider saturation, you mentioned a couple of things that you do consider if somebody's breaking the law, if there are violations. What do you consider?
Chairman, Representative Edwards, the grounds that we have for refusing liquor licenses are found in ORS 471313. And to give you kind of an encapsulation from it, some of the things that we look at have to do with very broad considerations. Is it somebody that's a wholesale business that's trying to get into the retail business or vice versa? And those things are prohibited. When it comes to the type of things the neighbors are talking about, we really look at the applicant. Has the applicant been convicted of violating liquor laws in this state, or have they ever been convicted of a felony? Those are things that we have to look at. Ultimately, we do have to look at their entire record, including passage of time. So the fact that somebody was convicted of a felony, if that felony conviction was in 1962, that may not be as relevant if they've now had a long record of operation or a long history without other problems. If the person has made false statements to the commission, we can deny the license. If the person has been found to have maintained an insanitary establishment, we could deny that. If the person is not of good repute and moral character, which is kind of a broad catch-all that may include both convictions and other behavior on their part, or if the person is in the habit of using alcohol or controlled substances to excess, that's a basis to deny it. For the person going into business, if they've had a poor record of compliance, that's the biggest one, that, again, violating liquor laws, that's something we look at. Then we look at the location itself, and that's where we look at whether or not there's been a history of serious and persistent problems at the location proposed to be licensed. So that would be if Joe's Bar was here and Joe's Bar had a whole bunch of problems and we issued them violations or maybe closed them down because of these problems, somebody else applies, that person is going to have to establish that if to get a license that they can operate the business in a way that they won't have a repeat of those same problems that happened before.
Any further questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McNeil, this has been presented as a recommendation of the task force. Did this come out of the task force unanimously?
Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, it was a consensus recommendation.
Well, I'm looking at a letter that was provided to the committee administrator after I specifically asked that question at the first hearing, and this letter now clarifies that, according to the chair, there were one or two members of the task force that disagreed with the recommendation.
That's correct. The rules that the committee was the subcommittee was set up under were such that if there were more than two objections to any proposal, then that proposal would not go forward. If there was a consensus, which meant that two or fewer people objected, then that would go forward.
And do you know what? I'm sorry. Follow
That's
up.
That's quite right.
Do you know what the basis of the dissenting members' objections was?
I don't. I was not, unfortunately, a member of or president of the committee. I do have somebody that was on the committee that's here. I don't know if she recalls specifically. She reviewed the minutes of the meeting, and there wasn't actually recorded in those minutes, who had objected or why. She referred to some notes taken by other committee member to see who it was that had objected. I believe one of the people objecting was there from Office of Neighborhood Involvement in the City of Portland. Another person was representing a Southeast Portland neighborhood in a crime prevention capacity. And I don't know the reason for the objection. I could call her up to see if she could help them.
Mr. Chair?
If that's what the representative wants, that's what we're going to do.
We appreciate the clarification.
Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Judith Brasanovich. I am the chair and was the chair during the part of the process where the governor had asked us to make statutory recommendations. This is the Joint Task Force on Saturation and Problem Area. And the way it worked, long before we decided any individual issue, we decided what would consensus be, because that varies, of course. People who work with groups know that. And in this instance, it was decided that it would be two or fewer people objecting. You asked about and so what we did is if it qualified for consensus, then that's how it went in the formal minutes. And only if it was not consensus, when we got near the end of that work that the governor had requested, only if there was not consensus would we take a formal vote, because it wasn't going forward, but we wanted to record the positions of the various entities. And because it qualified as consensus, there was no formal vote taken. The best memory I have of the basis for it, for the two people who dissented, were that they wanted it to be tied to giving the neighborhoods more time for input. And that was attempted. That did not pass with consensus, to have that more time. And because it didn't pass by consensus, a vote was taken on that. And I can, I can go through the minutes and find that for you if you'd like. OLCC actually voted as one of the members that it would like to have that time frame link. But I can't, my memory, I'd have to look at the minutes to tell you if you'd like to know how that vote went.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quite all right. Any Representative Holdy, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, for indulging me just for a minute. I'm looking at the grounds for refusing to issue a license in front of me here, and after hearing the public testimony and looking at this bill, it really doesn't look like this bill does anything except changing the temporary license from 180 days to, I guess, what's available is 120 days right now. So you're adding 60 days. And it appears to me also that the commission may refuse issuing a temporary license or revoke the license or refuse to issue a permanent license on those grounds are listed under 471.313. And many of the scenarios that came up from the Neighborhood Association are listed under 471.313 for grounds for refusing a license, but the OLCC, I guess, didn't find merit in what the Neighborhood Association claims to have existed. Or is it that we're using the word may refuse? Maybe we should put in a statute that you shall refuse if any of those situations exist. Would that fix the scenario of having a neighborhood being able to force OLCC to recognize these grounds for refusing to issue a license? I'm kind of confused why the OLCC didn't refuse a license in this particular neighborhood based on several of the grounds that are listed here, including the one that says there are sufficient license premises in the locality set out in the application, or that the granting of a license in the locality set out in the application is not demanded by public interest or convenience. So I'm just wondering why the OLCC doesn't look at these and revoke a license, I guess.
Well, Chairman and Representative Holvey, we do look at these, and we look at them very carefully and very seriously. There are also, when legislation is passed, of course, the agency then has to pass administrative rules, which also define how we interpret and apply these. And there's also other statutes that apply. We've got the Administrative Procedures Act, which puts requirements on agencies as well to establish the basis for what we're doing. A lot of the things that we look at is that there are, in our administrative rules, there may be a grounds to deny, but a person can provide good cause to overcome that denial basis. And that good cause often has to do with their actual operation of a business, their credible operating plan or security plan, the person's history of operation. Maybe they're a person who has a history of good operations that can come in. And it is difficult. When we have problems at a business, there's usually a combination of factors involved, and that's that you have a person who, for whatever reason, isn't able to operate their business effectively, and they also typically have problems in the area as well. So those two factors come together. We get an application from a new person that may come in, and they may propose an operation which is very different from the one that was licensed before. They may have specific proposals on how they're going to take care of it. They may have a history of operating and saying, look, I've run 10 nightclubs, and now I'm opening up a nightclub here, and through my operation at my other businesses, I've shown that I can be a good business operator, and here's my plan. And in that case, we may grant that person a license, even if there was an unsuccessful business in there previously, because we're convinced that that person can do the job. And I think part of what you heard here was testimony about a specific business, the Backswing, where the neighbors were concerned about problems. There's a new operator in the business now. It was closed for a couple of years. A new person came forward and put together a good operating proposal. And what I heard from the neighbors is they seem to be a good operator. So it's not as easy as saying that you know, this address is a bad address. We have to look at a number of factors.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much. Folks, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2170, and I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2170. Is there any discussion? Representative Escobar.
Yeah, I want to be clear that on 2170...
Oh, let me back up a little. Is there a motion to move this bill out of this committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move House Bill 2170 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Very good. Representative Berger moves House Bill 2170 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
How can I talk?
Yes, Representative Escobar.
I want to make it perfectly clear here where we have division lines here that we're getting together. I think that the Neighborhood Association has been dealt a very large misjustice by the City of Borland. There's nuisance ordinance to cover this. OLCC should not be monitoring what's going on within a city, but that municipality should be. Where's your police force? Where's your additional police force? Where's your council members that you should go to and say, these people are a problem. Here is a nuisance. You need to shut this thing down. And yet, obviously, that is not happening here. I think we went through this same thing with this same neighborhood last session. I want to say we had something in front of us about this. And again, we asked and begged to ask the question, where is your local police? Where is your local city? That city needs to step forth and work with the neighborhood association to make neighborhoods better. I think that city should actually have the ability and actually the responsibility to go forth and zone accordingly to stop saturations. But then that's a local issue, and I'm a local advocate. So that's why I think this is a local situation, and I'm sorry that the city didn't come forth and help you.
Any further discussion? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I mean, respectfully, I disagree with that comment. I think it really, we have set up a licensing authority in this state, and really, although certainly, you know, local law enforcement deals with problems that occur in or outside these establishments, when we're talking about who has the right to operate an establishment, that really is the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and that, I think, is why this bill is the appropriate place to have the discussion. I mean, we've heard from lots of neighborhood folks that they have tried to use the process that exists, and that's the process that exists right now, and to then take these temporary licenses, give them for even longer, I mean, frankly, I'm quite frustrated by the discussion, by being told that this was a consensus recommendation, and only when we press further for details do we find that the people who were on this task force, that who were there to represent neighborhoods, were protesting against it. So they were rolled over, basically. I mean, a lot of us have had that experience in this body, too, and we know what that's like. So I think I have not heard anybody really get up and make a compelling case for why we need to change the law as it is. If anything, it seems to me we ought to be looking at the law that exists and whether we need some tools that we don't have. So I just cannot support this bill.
Any further discussion?
Yeah.
Representative Edwards.
It's my impression that this bill has come forward in an attempt, and I could be wrong here, but it's my impression that this bill is an attempt to get a better handle on the exact problems that are brought forth by the neighborhood associations here. Am I missing something? I mean, I thought that this was by the idea of granting the six-month license, temporary license, was going to give them was going to make the OLCC more active in making sure that that new establishment was toeing the line, because they'd have to do it for 6 months, and then there would be a very easy process of just not renewing or extending them a permanent license. And from that angle, I mean, I'm going to end up, and I didn't have an axe to grind one way or the other on this issue. I think that what the neighborhoods brought forward here are legitimate concerns, and I commend them and their representatives for representing them well in this process. But I'm going to support this bill because what we got isn't working. I mean, it doesn't sound like what we have is working. And so it sounds to me that this task force got together with the idea that we're going to improve on this process. And while obviously to some folks it looks like a step backward, it seems to me like it might just be a step forward. And if it doesn't work, I'll work with you next session to craft something that does work better. So,
any further questions, comments, discussion? Representative Hovey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I somewhat agree with Representative Edwards on this. I'm looking at this bill, and all I see is extending the time period for 60 days, and also allowing the OLCC to refuse or revoke a temporary license on the grounds that they can refuse a regular license for. And so I think. You know, I just don't see that this bill does a whole heck of a lot, you know, for the concerns of the neighborhood, because all their concerns are already dealt with in statute, and perhaps there is, I guess, not a good way to compel the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to act in the total interest of the neighborhood association. I think their job is to weigh, their interest as well as the interest of industry and the community at large, and certainly the cities certainly have an ability to weigh in on this probably a little more than they may have in this scenario. I don't know. But I think I'm going to support the bill because I think that 60 days and extra for a temporary license gives a little more time for review and also gives the OLCC the ability to refuse the temporary license and revoke the temporary license on the grounds that are laid out here that I think should be looked at a little closer and maybe, having the OLCC look at how they can better interpret those statutes and put them into effect through rule, I suppose, because I think the intent of the statute is there to protect the neighborhood.
Mr. Chair, could I just make one more clarification, though? I think my reading of this bill is that under current law, these temporary licenses, which are for a shorter period of time, only apply on change of ownership applications, and that language is being deleted in this bill. And I'd ask the administrator if I'm reading this correctly, because it seems to me this bill then expands these licenses for a greater length of time into any applicant.
Yes, you're correct.
Mm-hmm. So it does definitely expand the current law. I mean, if people think that this is just a bill that doesn't really do anything, it really does make a significant expansion.
Any further questions or comments? Well, it does expand the law. It does expand the time period. I don't think this bill, whether it passes or not, is going to address the problems and concerns that the neighborhood associations brought here before us. I don't think it does either way. I don't think it does. If the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is not doing their job, they need to start doing it. If our local governments who are challenged and overburdened can't meet the challenges, we need to help them do that. I voted for similar language last session. I do support this bill, but there's no slam dunk in this building. So for all of those on either side of the issue, don't give up hope. Kristen, would you please call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 No.
No.
Aye. The motion carries, and I think the good chair has to carry this one on the floor.
Let me.
All right.
No,
okay, I'm going to open a, and if folks have to go to the restroom or whatever you have to do, I want to get through this agenda tonight. So, and we may as well get used to this kind of thing because it's just the way it's going to be. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2677.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2677 allows the Liquor Control Commission to distribute a wine self-distribution permit to United States manufacturer of wine or cider. It provides that wine self-distribution permit authorizes the holder to sell and transport wine or cider that the holder produces directly to retail licensees in Oregon in the same manner as a Oregon winery licensee. And committee members, and you have in front of you a -1 amendment from the bill's proponents that clarifies Section 2, Subsection 3, that a permit holder may sell at wholesale and transport wine or cider and the manufacturer produces directly to the commission or its licensees.
We have signed up here on, this is 2677.
Yes, that's correct.
Gary Conklin, Bill Perry. Then I'll take the other two after that. Paul, why don't you come on up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Gary Conkling, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association in support of House Bill 2677, which, as you just heard, would grant licensed out-of-state wineries the same privilege of self-distribution in Oregon as in-state wineries. This legislation, which represents a compromise between Oregon wineries and Oregon wine distributors, grew out of a recent decision by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to reject an application by a Washington winery for a warehouse license. Legal briefs filed in connection with an administrative review of that application pointed out the disparity in self-distribution privileges between in-state and out-of-state wineries, suggesting this disparity could be the basis for a challenge under the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Granholm, which you've heard about in a previous bill. To avoid any such challenge and to preserve the valuable privilege of self-distribution, the Oregon Wine Growers Association entered into a conversation with the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. And we agreed a reasonable position is to allow out-of-state wineries to apply to the OLCC for a wine distribution permit that would accord those wineries the same privileges enjoyed by Oregon wineries, at the same time being subject to the same restrictions as Oregon wineries, including payment of taxes. The wine self-distribution permit has important built-in limitations. For example, an out-of-state winery only may distribute wines or ciders it directly produces. In a very practical sense, this is not a privilege that will be used all that widely. We anticipate the most immediate interest in this privilege will come from wineries just across the Columbia River in Washington that have found it difficult to sell their wines to retailers in nearby cities in eastern Oregon. Oregon winery operators regard the privilege of self-distribution to retailers with the same level of importance as direct shipment to consumers, as I mentioned in previous testimony. Both of these distribution channels are crucial to the success of Oregon's predominantly small and medium-sized wineries, which aren't able to generate the volume of business that often can attract a distributor. To preserve their self-distribution privileges, Oregon winery operators understand that under Granholm, the same privilege cannot be withheld from similarly situated out-of-state wineries, which is why we have brought forward House Bill 2677 in alliance with the beer and wine distributors. In drafting House Bill 2677, we included language, this is our including language, that allowed a holder of a wine self-distribution permit to sell to licensed Oregon retailers. In fact, an Oregon winery license allows wineries to self-distribute to the commission itself, to distributors, and to other wineries, which may operate tasting rooms offering multiple wine labels, for example. So to make the wine distribution permit more parallel to the self-distribution privilege of Oregon wineries, we drafted the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 2677, which your administrator referred to. What this amendment does is modify Section 2 of the bill by allowing the holder of a wine self-distribution permit to self-distribute its own products to the OLCC or any other OLCC licensee in Oregon, which is basically the privilege that Oregon wineries have. We respectfully request passage of House Bill 2677 with the Dash 1 Amendment. Mr. Romaine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. Mr. Conkling, I'll give you a good history of this. I'm going to go a little different. The Granholm case, which you heard about earlier in direct-to-consumer, dealt with direct-to-consumer. It didn't deal with direct-to-retail. So the question is sort of open right now whether you can have, in effect, discriminatory or differential treatment in-state versus out-of-state on direct-to-retail. In other words, could you allow an in-state winery to ship directly to a retailer but not allow an out-of-state winery? That's an open question. It was litigated up in the Costco litigation up in Washington State, and the result was adverse to the interests that did not want it opened up, and basically they applied the privilege to say that what they said was if you allow your in-state wineries to ship directly to a retailer, you have to allow your out-of-state wineries the ability to ship directly to a retailer. We still think it's somewhat of an open question, but I'm not sure how open it is. It's one of those questions that you hate to have a lawyer look at because they have conflict, because it'd be a great case to take. However, it would take all of your money to litigate it, and we don't want to do that to you. So what we did was sit down and try and craft something that works. And what you do right now is you give your Oregon winery the privilege, and it is a privilege, to sell and transport. Transport means carry on their own trucks or their own vehicles to a retailer. So by doing the same thing to an out-of-state retailer or out-of-state winery, you're saying that they can sell to an Oregon retailer and transport on their own trucks to an Oregon retailer. It's the same privilege. The clarification language was necessary because I didn't realize that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission really doesn't call a winery license a retail license, even though they have a retail privilege. So the clarification language is necessary. Believe me, liquor law is very complex, and some of us love it that way.
Yeah, I can tell.
The whole idea here is just to level out the playing field. The key point is that this is different than direct shipping. Shipping means to give to another, in other words, to somebody else to carry for you. Transport means to take it yourself, and that's the key difference. You are allowing any winery out of state to transport their wine into the state and deliver it to a retailer. Practical effect, frankly, it goes on today already illegally, is that you're going to get, I'm shocked and appalled. You're going to get Washington wineries who will come across with a bunch of wine in their van or whatever and deliver to retailers. We know it goes on. I know from somewhat indirect personal experience that it goes on. I asked the wrong question in a restaurant that I have a part of.
and we know that deliveries occur. All you're doing is legalizing basically what occurs today. From a regulatory standpoint, there really isn't a big problem because it can only be the wine that they produce, so you're not going to have somebody, in effect, putting a load together and bringing it in. You are just allowing them the privilege to self-distribute. When they're that small, that they need that to get into the market. We have a lot of wholesalers, but frankly, the ones that are most effective kind of probably limit their book. Maybe, you know, that's their business decision. But you need to let these people get to market. We think it's a good bill. The process working with the Oregon wine growers is a little different for us. We're not used to doing that all the time, but it was a very pleasurable experience, and we urge you to pass the bill, as with the proposed amendment.
Thank you. Mr. Perry, please.
For the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Association. I was added to the panel at the end because they needed some youthful good looks. So,
somehow I got that.
Yeah.
Well, who's the wine's he been drinking?
So I was just going to give kind of an anecdotal experience of why we were supportive of this. There was a specific restaurant in Pendleton that wants some Walla Walla wine, which is right across the border. And what happens is they only buy about a case a month. And so their local distributor, it's not really cost effective for them to take it, warehouse it, and ship it. And so they don't carry the brand of wine. I mean, and I completely understand the economics of it. So that Pendleton restaurant drives to Columbia Distributing in downtown Portland to get their wine from Walla Walla. And so it's just an example of if a winery is in a local area on some of these border communities and want to sell to a local restaurant, we just think that they should have the ability to do it. Once again, they need to be licensed by OLCC. Everybody needs to pay their taxes. I mean, that's, to me, is not an issue. But in the small restaurants in these rural communities, there's just not a cost-effective reason for the distributor to carry it. And so there should be an avenue for that to happen.
Thank you. Any questions for this esteemed panel? All right. Very good. Thank you very much, guys. Donna Vandell, please, one more time.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, my name is Donna Vandell. I'm the Technical Services Coordinator for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The OLCC does not oppose this bill's basic objective, which is to permit out-of-state wine and cider manufacturers to self-distribute their own product to retailers. And again, we're not talking about distribution to consumers as we were under the previous bills. However, we believe that safeguards are needed to protect the state's ability to assess and collect privilege taxes and to have meaningful sanctions for noncompliance. We agree with the requirement in the bill that the out-of-state manufacturer must transport the product into Oregon. Due to the large quantities of alcoholic beverages involved in self-distribution to retailers, we believe it's in the state's regulatory interest that the product remains in the control of a licensed entity until it's delivered to the licensed retailer. The OLCC's concerns about the bill center on the potential loss of state privilege tax revenue, which is substantial. Under current law, we have an effective method of determining who owes privilege taxes and for collecting the tax because the reporting and payment involve in-state licensed entities. OLCC currently obtains reports on wine that is shipped into the state for resale from both the manufacturer and from the importing distributor. This allows us to cross-check the reports to make sure that they're accurate. In most cases, it's the distributor who is licensed in Oregon who is responsible for payment of the taxes owed. This means that if the tax is not paid, we have recourse against the distributor to suspend or cancel their Oregon license and to impose criminal and civil penalties. Under this bill, the responsibility for reporting the quantities of wine or cider transported into the state and for paying the tax rests solely on the out-of-state manufacturer. We have no method to cross-check their reports to make sure that they are accurate, and we have no effective sanction if the out-of-state winery fails to pay the taxes owed to Oregon. Even though we could revoke their wine self-distribution permit, these entities are not subject to Oregon's jurisdiction for civil or criminal sanctions. Washington is the only state we know of that currently allows self-distribution to retailers by manufacturers starting just this past year. However, Washington's law contains a critical component that this bill does not have. It requires the retailers who choose to receive shipments directly from manufacturers to also obtain a permit and to report on the amount of wine shipments they receive. This provides the critical cross-checking mechanism that is missing from this bill to help ensure that taxes are being paid. At a minimum, we believe that this bill should include a requirement that the Oregon retailers who choose to receive wine directly from wholesalers report to the state on the amount of wine they receive. The bill should also expressly prohibit retailers from receiving products from any out-of-state manufacturer who does not hold a self-distribution permit in Oregon. And ideally, payment of the privilege tax should occur at the retailer level. The potential loss of revenue to the state under this bill is substantial. Without an effective method to audit and collect the taxes on wine shipped to retailers, we could lose over time up to $15 million as manufacturers learn that we are unable to collect the taxes owed and therefore their voluntary compliance diminishes. We do have several other technical concerns about the bill in its present form, one of which I believe is addressed by the Dash Amendment. In addition, we just have a concern that Section 4 of the bill requires the out-of-state manufacturers to maintain records, but eliminates the requirement that the records be maintained in Oregon. The OLCC does not have the resources to travel to other states to audit records. Therefore, the bill should require the out-of-state manufacturers to make their records available to us upon request. Finally, Section 3 of the bill states that the minimum bond for a self-distribution permit is $1,000, but it doesn't specifically require a bond, and this should be added to the bill. We've only received this bill in the past week. We may not have identified all of the issues that are present, but we do hope to work with the committee to address the privilege tax and other issues that we've identified thus far. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Well, thank you very much. Okay, is there anyone else who would like to testify today to House Bill 2677? All right, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2677, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2171.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2171 was pre-session filed at the request of the Liquor Control Commission. It is similar in scope to House Bill 2488, which we heard earlier. However, it limits the issuance of the permit to persons with a license issued by this state or another state that authorizes a person to manufacture wine or cider. The measure also establishes procedures for issuing the permit, also imposes requirements for sales and shipments under the permit, and establishes violations for selling to minors or selling without possession of a valid permit. The measure takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment signing day.
Judith Brasanovich. Did I get it right that time?
You did. That's great.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Judith Brasanovich. I'm the Director of Administrative Policy and Process at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. We're here to support House Bill 2171 submitted by OLCC. And I don't want to repeat a lot of the testimony already given in connection with 2488. The Granholm decision requires the equalizing the privileges between in and out of state wine producers. This bill does that, and it stops there. It does not also include retailers. It does not include grower sales privilege holders, although we don't have a problem with that. It's a relatively small number, and there are also manufacturers. This bill is based essentially on the Washington model, the post-Granholm legislation that the state of Washington enacted, and I believe that's attached to the testimony. I won't repeat the reasons why we don't include retailers. That's in the testimony I gave to 2488, and it's in the written testimony as well. Other features. The wine shipper permit will be issued just only to those people who hold a manufacturer license in this state or another state, the equivalent in another state. The fee is $50. That is what's considered to be part of the existing license for wineries, and that would be the fee that would be applied to out-of-state wineries. Everyone would apply for it, in-state and out-of-state, and would be renewed annually. The annual renewal would be automatic for the in-state because it's part of the larger fee they pay for a winery license. And so $50 in effect is being collected from both in-state and out-of-state. As you've already heard, sale and shipment is under this permit may be used only for personal purposes and not for resale, and only may be made to persons under the age of 21 or over the age of 21 or older. There's no specific limitation as to quantity in either this or 2488. Package labeling and delivery verification requirements are in the bill. We have some other provisions that don't appear in 2488 that I'd just like to point out. In this bill, the commission may refuse to issue or may suspend or revoke a direct shipper permit if the holder is not complying with the law. And some other penalties. Any person who knowingly or negligently delivers wine or cider to a minor or visibly intoxicated person violates ORS 47.410. And that is currently in the reciprocal statute, and we think that's a good protection. A person who makes direct shipments to Oregon residents without a wine shipper permit, we have a provision for that. There's also similarly not one in 2488. And any person who knowingly makes, participates in, transports, or receives a shipment of wine or cider in violation of this law is also a provision there. If this bill is enacted, it will equalize the privilege for direct shipment of wine and cider in-state and out-of-state in terms of manufacturers, thereby fully complying with Granholm. Yet it is unencumbered with other issues that go outside of the Granholm requirements or are unrelated, actually, to direct shipping. And it also has provisions for compliance. It's based on the Washington model, which has not been challenged. And we urge your support of House Bill 2178.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was noticing I asked a question in House Bill 2488 about the annual fee and the bond that isn't required of the grower sales privilege license. Is that also in this bill, 2171?
No, but it should be. We need to amend our own bill to include that bond provision.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions? And the comment that was made earlier that people already ship wine down here illegally, you don't have to respond now, but that's pretty striking testimony, and I would like some kind of response from the commission on that and the frequency of that and what you do about it or want to do about it or anything like that. And clearly, if we pass this bill, it will be a moot point. But that is disconcerting testimony to me. All right. Any more further questions, comments, concerns? All right. Thank you, Ms. Bersanovich. I appreciate it. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2171. Open up public hearing on House Bill 2168. I have no one.
Nope. Oh, I'll just review the bill from the committee. House Bill 2168 was also pre-session filed on behalf of the Liquor Control Commission. It does three things. It modifies the fee for a temporary sales license from $25 for events lasting 5 hours or less and $25 for each additional period of 5 hours to a flat fee of $50 per day. It allows certain types of temporary sales applicants, such as those that are not exempted under ORS 471-190, such as a for-profit entity, to designate a no minors area after their plan for restricting minors access to alcoholic beverages is approved by the commission. Finally, it fixes a conflict between ORS 471-190, which allows any person with a temporary sales license to sell alcohol by raffle, and ORS 471-408, which says that only a charitable nonprofit organization may only sell wine. It fixes the conflict by removing the enabling language in ORS 471-190.
Thank you, Teresa. I have no one signed up to testify. Does anyone want to testify? Mr. Conkling, come on up, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for letting me just say a word. For the record, I'm Gary Conkling, representing the Oregon Wine Growers. In the discussion over House Bill 2488, the agency referred to an issue that does deal with temporary sales licenses and made a suggestion about resolving that problem, which they're quite correct is not exactly related to direct shipment in House Bill 2168. And
we would be open to do that. I'm sorry that that opportunity wasn't suggested or made clearer. But I don't know what your intentions are tonight, Mr. Chair, but we would entertain at least the opportunity to see if we could work out that particular problem on House Bill 2168 between now and some reasonable period of time. And if so, that might eliminate at least one problem in another bill that you have in front of your committee. So I'm not trying to slow up action, but in light of the agency's comments, it's probably a useful thing for us to see if we can solve one problem in a bill that's related to the problem that it deals with.
Well, I'm all for that. Thank you very much. Does anyone else like to? Does anyone have any questions of Mr. Conklin? Is there any more? Would anyone else like to testify? House Bill 2168. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2168, and I think that was good advice. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2169.
Committee members, House Bill 2169 eliminates the prorated license fee for licenses that are issued by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission for less than a full year. The rationale behind this is because the fees that are levied by the commission are based on two factors, the geographic area where the business is located and the issuance date of the license. This measure is streamlining in nature in that it will eliminate that and just have a flat fee for the full year.
Very good. I have no one signed up to testify to this House bill. Would anyone like to testify to this bill? All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2169, open up a work session on House Bill 2169, and I would happily entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Smith.
I move House Bill 2169 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Great. Representative Smith, boy, I tell you, I'm getting giddy myself. I could never have been an astronaut. Representative Smith has moved House Bill 2169 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right. Well, then, Kristen, call the roll, please.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Esquivel.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Holby.
Aye.
Representative
Smith.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum. Aye.
Chair Shockley.
Aye. Motion carried.
Mr. Chair.
Consent.
All right. Representative Smith, speak you to it. Move to we on the consent calendar. Mm-hmm. Is there any discussion to the motion? Is there any objection? So moved. I'm going to be adjourned.
Oh, okay.
Damn. Those are